Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Welcome to episode 12 of Crimatorium, the place where crime resides. I'm Madeline, and I will be guiding you through the case of a grieving father dressed in wolf's clothing. Consider this the Halloween episode that arrived late to the party. Please listen until the end for a promo from a true crime podcast that you won't want to miss. Grab your beverage of choice and let's get on with the show. This episode contains graphic violence and descriptions that are disturbing regarding a pregnant woman and her unborn child. I will give a warning beforehand, and you can skip ahead of that part if you'd like. Santa Clara, California, nicknamed the Mission City, is the home of many high-tech companies: Oracle, Hewlett-Packard, NVIDIA, and Intel. It is also the birthplace of Doreen Ray Hitchens, who was born on November 29, 1952, to Franklin and Catherine Hitchens, and was the fourth of five children. The family was tight-knit and loving, enjoying family activities such as fishing and camping. Doreen was described as an angel who had a cheery attitude and a generous spirit. Her husband Charles said of Doreen, quote, "When she smiled and laughed, you couldn't help not loving her. She was always giving," unquote. These qualities led her to pursue a career in the medical field, and she went on to become a physical therapist. In 1975, she met William Michael Dennis, called Mike for short, a technician at the Lockheed factory, an aerospace manufacturing plant. Mike suffered significant hearing loss as a child, which caused him to stutter. He also wore a hearing aid, which back in those days was wired and a component of it sat in your pocket. Due to these reasons, Mike was a depressive type. He was described by some as confrontational and unhappy. It seems that he and Doreen were on opposite sides of the personality spectrum. But despite this, they got married in 1975 after only a few months of dating. Mike felt he had found the one in Doreen. In 1976, the couple gave birth to a son they named Paul Dennis. Mike relished his role as a father, but the marriage didn't hold up well with the added stress of parenthood, and Mike was being treated for depression. When Doreen didn't want to live with Mike's moodiness any longer, she filed for divorce in 1977. Doreen was given full custody of Paul, and Mike regularly visited his son, but was bitter about the divorce. In 1978, Doreen was still working as a physical therapist. On her way home from work one afternoon, her car broke down and she pulled off on the side of the road. Charles Herbert, a cheery-looking man with curly red hair, stopped to help Doreen. The two conversed under the hood of Doreen's car, and they hit it off. Doreen was impressed with Charles's stable life. He owned his own home and a successful carpet business, and soon the two were a couple. They went on to marry later that year, and Doreen gave birth to a daughter, Deanna, in 1979. Soon after, Doreen quit her job as a physical therapist and became a secretary for Charles's carpet business. And by all outward appearances, they were a happy family. Mike continued to visit Paul on the weekends as he lived close by. It is said that Mike was still bitter about the divorce. One sunny California day in February of 1980, Doreen was doing household chores while 3-year-old Paul was playing in the backyard. Doreen would periodically check on Paul to make sure that he was in sight and doing okay, until one such time that she peered out the window and could not see him. Feeling panicked, she hurried outside and frantically searched for him. Those of us with kids are familiar with this overwhelming feeling of dread. Looking across the yard, she noticed a hole in the fence that led to the family swimming pool. As she approached the pool, she realized a nightmare that no parent wants to live. She saw her beloved 3-year-old son, Paul, floating in the pool. Paul was transported to the hospital, where he was placed on life support for a week. After 3 days of being removed from life support, he died. He was born on April 17, 1976, and died just short of his 4th birthday, February 13, 1980. As to be expected, this was such a tragic loss for Doreen. Mike, Paul's father, was also devastated. He blamed Doreen and Charles for Paul's death, making the wild accusation that they did it on purpose so that they could erase Mike from their lives. He even filed a wrongful death suit against Doreen and Charles. The case went to trial in March of 1982, and the jury ruled in favor of the Herberts. After the trial was over, they asked Mike to never come to their house again. Doreen only saw him once after this, at a shopping center. In 1984, Doreen discovered that she was pregnant again. This was good news, as she had suffered 2 miscarriages since the death of Paul. As the pregnancy progressed, they found out that she was going to have a boy. The Herbert family was ecstatic. After the lawsuit against Doreen and Charles, Mike's life took a downward spiral. He lost his position as a technician at Lockheed and had to take a lower-paying job in order to remain employed there. The bitterness of the divorce from Doreen and the grief over the loss of Paul continued eating at him. Because he lived near Doreen and Charles, he was able to keep tabs on what was happening in their lives, and it soon became apparent that she was pregnant again. Doreen was a petite woman. She stood about 5 feet tall. Once she became far along into the pregnancy, her sister teased her, saying that she was as far out as she was high. We're going to break now for a word from our sponsor. Today's episode is presented by State Bags. State Bags makes beautiful, well-made, inclusively cool products. While using the power of business to give back to shift the narrative around social injustice. For every State Bag purchased, State hand-delivers a backpack packed with essential tools for success to an American child in need. but their commitment goes way beyond simply a material donation. State Bags has your back, and part of that commitment is making a difference in local kids' lives. To get you ready for your commute or wherever you are traveling next, State is offering our listeners 15% off their next purchase at statebags.com using the code POD. That's 15% off your next purchase using the code POD, P-O-D, at statebags.com. State Bags, they have your back. On Halloween night of 1984, Doreen was almost 9 months pregnant by that time, so she stayed home and handed out candy while Charles took Deanna trick-or-treating. Charles saved a few houses for Doreen to take Deanna to for a visit and some Halloween candy. After the two got home, Charles went to the liquor store and claims he was gone for about 15 minutes. He asked Doreen to lock the door after he left. Sometime around 9 p.m., there was a sharp knock on the front door of the Herbert house. Deanna, who was 4 at the time, has since described it as aggressive. The two proceeded to answer the door together, and Deanna heard the man say, "I'm going to kill you." Doreen screamed at Deanna to hide before the man at the door, in a wolf mask, began stabbing Doreen with a machete. Once he was done, the man walked through the house in search of Deanna. As panicked and as frightened as she was, she stayed quiet and hidden, moving only to get her blanket for comfort. Eventually, the man got spooked by something and fled the house through the front door. Once outside, he threw the wolf mask into the yard near the porch. Charles arrived home after not being gone long and noticed the front door was unlocked. Once he stepped inside, he saw Doreen lying bleeding on the entry room floor. He also looked over and saw the baby. Thinking at first she had miscarried, he saw a hand lying on the floor near the baby. It was Doreen's. He tried to stop her bleeding by holding her arm tight, but noted she had severe cuts to her stomach and neck. At some point, Charles slipped and fell in Doreen's blood, getting it all over his clothes. He attempted to call 911, but for some unknown reason was unable to get through. He ended up calling the fire department and a neighbor. After this, Charles found Deanna hiding in the living room. He pulled her away to the kitchen so that she couldn't see any more than she already had. He continued to try and stop Doreen's bleeding until help arrived. The police and paramedics responded to the fire department dispatch and arrived at the Herbert home around 9:15. Charles was bloody and his breath smelled of alcohol, and the police were immediately suspicious that he was involved. Deanna was placed with the neighbor while the police and paramedics conducted their work. Charles was hysterical and the police handcuffed him and put him in a patrol car. Reserve San Jose Police Officer Glenn Sutvin was one of the responding officers. He and some of the others searched the house just in case the perpetrator was still there. Paramedics noted that Doreen was still alive and she was placed in an ambulance to be transported to the hospital. Doreen was pronounced dead upon arrival to the hospital. Inside the home, the crime scene was extremely bloody. Officers noted a severed hand lying in a pool of blood near the body of the baby. The wolf mask worn by the perpetrator was found in the front yard near the porch. Charles was later questioned as to whether he recognized it, and he claimed that he did not. During the course of the investigation that night, the police learned that Doreen had been married previously and that it was a contentious split. Sergeant James Moran and four other officers went to Mike Dennis's house around 12:30 a.m. and rang his doorbell several times. It was obvious somebody was home as they heard water running and lights were on. The officer surmised that he may be cleaning up bloodied clothes or wounds. Finally, dispatch called Mike at his home and informed him that police were at his door and to answer it. Mike answered the door and he was wearing a robe. However, he didn't look as if he'd been asleep. Sergeant Moran explained that his ex-wife Doreen had been attacked and that they wanted to question him. Mike let the officers into his home and they went into the kitchen. The officers informed Mike that Doreen had been murdered, to which he responded, "You're kidding." It was noted that Mike had an injury on his right hand wrapped in gauze that had obviously been bleeding profusely. The officers asked Mike for some identification, and he told them that it was upstairs. Not wanting him to go alone in case he tried to escape or get a weapon, they followed him. They reached the master bedroom where it appeared that Mike was confused as to where his identification was. He kept glancing toward his headboard, which made the officers suspicious. Finally, one of the officers found his wallet, and Mike removed his identification from it. Mike consented to a search of his home, and officers located a loaded revolver behind his headboard. Sergeant Moran went into the garage where the washer and dryer was located and found blood drops. There were also blood drops in the kitchen, a pair of blood-stained jeans on Mike's bed, bloody gauze in the bathroom garbage, and various blood drops in his truck. Mike's mother lived in an apartment in the rear of his house, and she was located in her bedroom asleep. Mike was taken to the station and waived his rights to an attorney and agreed to a taped interview. He denied killing Doreen. Mike was asked about any costumes he may have worn for Halloween in previous years. He mentioned several, but did not mention the wolf mask. When asked about how he cut his hand, he stated that he had done so by throwing a knife into the air and catching it by the blade. During the ongoing investigation, police were able to obtain a photograph of Mike wearing a wolf mask that was identical to the one found in the Herbert's yard.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
A week later, an official search warrant was served, and police found a label belonging to a Stanley 18-inch machete, along with a receipt for a purchase of a machete from a local hardware store. No machete was ever found at the house. A machete would be purchased at the hardware store that matched the label found at Mike's home and used in the trial. In the garage, the police found what looked like two coffins and two anchors. It would later come out at the trial that Mike had originally planned on placing Charles and Doreen in these coffins and drowning them in the ocean, like his son Paul drowned. Thank you. William Michael Dennis went to trial in July of 1988. He was charged with first-degree murder for Doreen and second-degree murder for the killing of the unborn baby. In Deputy District Attorney Paula Cootie's opening statement, she told jurors that the wolf mask found on the scene is identical to the one the defendant wore the previous year to a Halloween party. She also said, quote, "You will recognize the mask, and you will recognize him for what he is, a murderer," unquote. She went on to tell the jury another detail, quote, "He took it off so she would see him. He wanted her to know who was doing this," unquote. Deanna Herbert was the first to testify for the prosecution. She was only 4 years old when her mother, Doreen, was murdered in front of her. She was 8 years of age when she testified. When asked what happened on that Halloween night, Deanna told her story in a quiet, clear voice. She and her mother, Doreen, answered a knock at the door together. In front of them stood a man wearing a wolf mask who uttered the words, "I'm going to kill you." Doreen told the man to get out of her house, and Deanna said that, quote, "My mommy told me to get behind the couch, so I did," unquote. Several of Herbert's neighbors testified to seeing a man in a wolf mask hanging around the Herbert home that Halloween. Questions had been raised about whether or not it was obvious that Doreen was pregnant, and witnesses testified to the fact that it was. The direction the defense was going with this is that Mike didn't know Doreen was pregnant, so therefore he didn't purposely murder her unborn baby. The following is the medical examiner's testimony regarding the injuries to Doreen and her unborn baby. This is graphic and may be disturbing to some. Skip ahead about a minute if you don't want to hear it. Dr. John Hauser performed the autopsy on Doreen and baby Herbert on November 1st. Doreen died of severe chopping wounds that resulted in severe blood loss. The wounds would have been inflicted by a heavy bladed weapon, much like a Stanley 18-inch machete. Doreen suffered many cuts to the back and sides of her head, with some cuts penetrating the skull. The wounds on the right side of her head were particularly brutal. Some fractured the skull, one penetrated 2 inches into the brain. Her left hand was severed above the wrist. This hand was found near the baby's body in the living room. Her back and shoulders received severe wounds that penetrated bone. Her right breast had been cut 3 times and stabbed. Her legs and thighs sustained chopping wounds, which resulted in gaping cuts and a broken femur. Her abdomen had a 9-inch gaping wound. She had also suffered many other cuts while her unborn baby was still inside of her. The umbilical cord was cut near where it had been attached to the baby. The baby was separated from Doreen's body due to her abdominal wounds. Little 4-year-old Deanna was a witness to some degree to all of this. Charles told police that Deanna told him that she heard the baby crying during this attack. It is true that the baby was old enough to live outside the womb, but there was a dispute as to whether the baby actually took a breath or not. The baby suffered some severe wounds. He had a cut on his head that penetrated into the bone. His left shoulder blade was cut through. His right thigh area, including the penis, scrotum, and perineum, were cut. His left leg was severed below the knee. The medical examiner also stated, quote, a large 5-inch wound cut through half of his body. This wound extended from his upper right abdomen through his left chest to his left armpit, cutting through the shoulder blade. The second thoracic vertebra, the liver, and one lung, and transecting the heart. This wound stopped his heart and circulation. Examination of his lungs demonstrated they had never been expanded and there was no air in them. The fetus never breathed or lived independently of Doreen. The injuries to Doreen and her fetus prevented the fetus from ever breathing, unquote. The defense called friends of Mike's who testified that he was compassionate and a good-natured person who was proud of his son, that the drowning of his son Paul affected his job performance and he became withdrawn afterwards. Psychiatrist Dr. Samuel Benson interviewed the defendant 5 times previous to the trial. He recounted the fact that Mike was hearing impaired and wasn't able to get any girlfriends. He then met and married Doreen, and he claimed that she had affairs and smoked pot. He also claimed that Paul didn't want to return to Doreen's home after the visitation with his dad was over. It was clear to Dr. Benson that Mike blamed Doreen for the death of Paul. He felt that she should have jumped in the pool after him instead of running to the neighbor's house. He felt that Doreen wasn't sad about the death of Paul and that she had done it on purpose to get Mike out of hers and Charles's lives. Dr. Benson felt that Mike wanted retribution for Paul's death and became fixated on killing Doreen. He said he was suffering from a mental illness and delusions. Mike admitted to Dr. Benson to killing Doreen, but claims he did not know she was pregnant. He also confided to the doctor that he had planned on drowning Doreen and Charles by placing them in body bags, putting them in those boxes found in his garage, weighing them down with anchors, driving them out to sea and throwing them overboard. Mike's mother got on the stand and recounted details of Mike's life, including awards he had received. She also stated that the two ate dinner together that night at around 6:15. And she retired to her separate apartment in the home at 8:15. A neighbor of the defendant claimed that Mike gave her some misdelivered mail at around 6:30 and told her he was going to a Halloween party. The defendant didn't testify in the guilt or penalty phase of his trial. In August of 1988, the jury returned with a guilty verdict for first-degree murder of Doreen and second-degree murder of the unborn baby. Before the sentence was passed, Mike sobbed and said that if his death could bring his son Paul back, then take me now. He was sentenced to death by gas chamber in the San Quentin prison in San Quentin, California. Epilogue. In 2019, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed an executive order to put an indefinite moratorium on executions, saying that the death penalty is a failure. The death chamber has been closed, and no inmates have been executed in California since 2006. Mike Dennis has been a model prisoner, so much so that he spends 6 hours a day outside of his cell on death row. He and other inmates can play basketball, watch TV, and run around the prison yard. The defendant has filed several appeals and petitions over the years, the latest one being in 2017. Some of the points brought up are whether or not he knew Doreen was pregnant, the definition of murder for a baby who never took an independent breath, Mike's different mental illness diagnoses, ineffective counsel, and there were several other points introduced by the defendant, all have been denied. It is said that Mike has never shown remorse for killing Doreen and her unborn baby. Officers that responded to the Herbert house that Halloween night say it was straight out of a Stephen King movie. There was blood covering the foyer and a jack-o'-lantern that was displayed in the house. The blood on the floor was thick and stuck to the shoes of the officers. Some paramedics and officers needed counseling, and some even quit after what they witnessed in the Herbert house. Mike still has friends that believe he just went insane for a brief period of time and should not be in prison, that his character was strong and he was pushed over the edge. In an interview in 2016, Mike stated to reporters that he is appealing his death sentence because he believes he should have been charged with manslaughter, not first-degree murder. He said he was blinded by grief over the drowning death of his 4-year-old son when he killed his ex-wife. "I lost a son, and I have to live every day with that knowledge," Dennis said. "I want a new trial. If people knew what I'd been through, the verdict would have been different." William Michael Dennis sits on death row at the San Quentin prison. Since the death penalty has been put on hold indefinitely, it is unlikely that he will be executed, as he is 70 years old now. Doreen's father, Frank Hitchens, died in 2007. He stated in an interview that Doreen's murder had ruined his life and that if he ever saw Mike Dennis outside of prison, he would kill him. Doreen's mother, who by all accounts is still alive, echoed her husband's sentiment. Charles Herbert sued the city of San Jose for being arrested falsely in front of the neighbors. I was unable to find what became of this suit. The following is a promo from a true crime podcast called Riddle Me That. The research and narrating is excellent, and it's a go-to favorite of mine. Links for the show will be in the notes below.
Hi, I'm Jules from Riddle Me That True Crime. I have a passion for all things crime and psychology, and I have a PhD in transpersonal counseling, so I love research and I like to do deep dives into cases. I recently did a 3-part series on the disappearance of Madeline McCann. I promise you, this is coverage that you haven't heard anywhere else. I also do cases that are lesser known, such as the case of Keith Warren, who in 1986 was found hanging from a tree in Silver Spring, Maryland. His death was classified as a suicide, but things don't add up in the case. Keith was found wearing clothes that weren't his. The 911 caller said that someone had committed suicide in her boyfriend's basement. And when emergency services arrived, the body was in the woods and not in the basement. Keith's mother, Mary, would receive a manila envelope that would call the suicide conclusion by police into question. There were copies of police photos and a note that predicted the death of Keith's friend, Mark Finley. Mark Finley calls Mary to unburden himself, but he would never get the chance. Before he gets a chance to meet up with Mary, he is killed in a freak accident, though some believe it was murder. 2020 is a strange year, and it is comforting to have a favorite podcast to keep you company. I would love to be that podcast. Subscribe to Riddle Me That True Crime on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for joining me for episode 12 of Crimatorium. Please take a moment to rate and review the podcast. It helps with the growth of the show, and it just feels good seeing lovely reviews. All episodes are researched, written, edited, and narrated by me, Madeline.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, Our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.